Hello, and welcome back to Screamatics. I'm Jason Jenkins. Call me Jinx. For this episode, we're doing something a little different. We've invited on a special guest and allowed him to pick a film of his choosing to chat about. Now, imagine, if you will, a group of young female friends are out for a fun night in Austin, Texas, unaware that they're being stalked by a scarred stuntman driving around in a skull-emblazoned muscle car. We spend time with them at a couple of bars. We get to like them. Hell, we even get to like the stuntman. Hard not to, given that he's played by Kurt Russell. Just as we're certain that our heroines are going to have to eventually fend off this villain in the film's final act, the movie shocks viewers by eliminating our leads at the film's midpoint, hitting the reset button, moving to Tennessee with a new group of gals who are being similarly stalked by stuntman Mike. Thing is, this new group is hardly helpless and will possibly wind up giving Mike a run for his money and the right of his life. The movie is, of course, Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof, one half of 2007's Grindhouse double bill, which also included Robert Rodriguez's Planet Terror, and a handful of incredibly fun fake trailers sandwiched in between. And our guest is Mickey Fisher. You might know Mickey as the creator of CBS's Extant, a show that you should really check out. Both of its seasons are available on DVD and Blu-ray and should be of great interest to genre fans. It's sci-fi, but its setup, initially concerning an astronaut impregnated by an extraterrestrial presence, is genuinely creepy, as are several set pieces throughout the show's run. In addition to Extant, Mickey has worked on Nat Geo's upcoming Mars miniseries, and is now in the writer's room for the Guillermo del Toro-inspired series The Strain, working on its fourth season. Now, Mickey, to start, I have to ask two questions right off the bat. One, even though I've known you for, 15 years, I'm pretty sure I already know the answer, but why did you choose Death Proof to talk about? And two, echoing a sentiment of yours from a while back, how is it that America let down two of the coolest working filmmakers today by not showing up to what should have been one of their greatest successes? I mean, it was a double feature. There were fake trailers. The movies were a blast. What the hell happened?
I don't know. That still, like, to me is just one of like the saddest things that I've ever seen. Two guys who really endeavored to put on a show, you know, which is something that, you know, everybody makes movies and you put them out there and you market them and you promote them. But you don't really get the feeling anymore, like, other than from, you know, from guys like this and certainly from Tarantino, because he just did it with Hateful Eight too, where you really feel like they're putting on a show. These are showmen. You know, it's like going to the theater. There's a curtain up. There is an overture. The band starts playing. The lights go down. And you really get that sense. And these two guys are really trying to give us that and give us like a genuine experience in the theater. And just unfortunately, like, you know, a handful of people showed up. I think it was me, you, Tarantino's mom, you know, Rodriguez's cousins, and there's like a handful of other people. So yeah, so there's a part of me that's always felt a little bit like these movies really didn't get their shot. And then also, like, over the years, Death Proof has kind of like become the sort of like it's become the much maligned part of his catalog. You know, I mean, the guy, unfortunately, like, even himself, he'll say, you know, that's his sort of worst movie, you know, by far. And I think that so there's a part of me that feels it was a little bit unfairly maligned. But then, as part of the reason why I picked it for this podcast, which is that, you know, as long as I've known you, you have been certainly a much more encyclopedic, you've had much more encyclopedic knowledge of the horror genre, and specifically like the slasher genre and things like that, a lot more so than I would have. But I think that there's the sort of Venn diagram of the horror movie, slasher movie, Tarantino, our shared love of a lot of these things, muscle cars, exploitation, the grindhouse thing, all that stuff. I felt like this would be a really fun one to talk about. And to the extent that I even discarded the first idea that I proposed, which was picking three episodes of The Twilight Zone, because I know we both have a shared love of Rod Serling. But this just felt like, you know what? This movie deserves people still talking about it.
Yeah, I agree. And it's, you know, it's kind of sad that the movies feel like they're almost lost to time at this point. I think the only reason that the movies have stuck around in a way is because they're a part of the filmographies of those two filmmakers. Otherwise, I mean, I think if anybody else had tried the same experiment, I mean, one, they probably wouldn't have gotten the budget that they did to make these movies. But two, right. I don't think anybody would give a shit about either film, Planet Terror or Death Proof at this point. They would be fun little movies for people to discover at some point. But otherwise, I don't think many people would really know much about them, which is crazy considering that even though Grindhouse was kind of a box office failure, it did seem to inspire loads of grindhousey knockoffs for the next four or five years, you know, most straight to video. But I mean, you know, there were a couple like
you know, hobo with a shotgun, and even Machete, which was born out of one of the fake trailers in front of Grindhouse, you know, the Danny Trejo movie. It even got a sequel. But, you know, otherwise, sadly, I mean, when it comes to Tarantino's filmography, certainly Death Proof is the last movie that people seem to talk about, which is kind of sad, because even though, you know, I think in that interview you referenced, like, he called it like his left-handed movie, or he said something like, it's not bad for a left-handed movie. And it's like, yeah, you know, so far as his movies go, I probably wouldn't consider it above any other film, but it's still pretty damn good, you know?
Yeah, any other of his films, you're
yes.
saying? Like, yeah, in his you know, catalog, in his canon right now, I definitely, after doing a lot of soul searching over the last few days about this, I definitely feel like it's you know, it doesn't earn its spot above any of the other movies, but... But that said, you know, and especially like in rewatching it for this conversation, there are just so many, little treasures and little details and great little things. Like, I really get the sense, especially watching it even more so this time, that this is a guy who was really just following the muse into whatever random darkened corner it was, you know, it was beckoning him into. You know, I mean, like, all of his fetishes, all of his obsessions are on display. And not only on display, but they're just like indulged, you know, all this stuff, like the, you know, the sort of foot fetish thing that he's become famous for. I mean, there's like one scene that Rodriguez directed, the, you know, the vampire movie from Dusk Till Dawn. Gosh, yeah. I can't believe I couldn't come up with that right now, but like, there's, you know, sort of one scene in that, or there's like a couple references to Pulp Fiction. I mean, the bare feet are all over this movie. They're there in the opening frames. They're there in the middle of frames. They're like rain drenched, you know, and you just get the sense that this is a guy who is just sort of like indulging every whim. And there's a part of me, I have so much admiration for that freedom too. And such a, not a jealousy, but just like a man, it's like ultimate wish fulfillment. You had to play with all the cool toys. I don't know. So there's a part of me that really appreciates it on that level, even though it's not, I'm certain, you know, doesn't stand up to the more formalized stuff.
Sure. You know, there is something that's kind of great about it. And maybe it's because they were trying to harken back to that sort of grindhouse aesthetic when movies were so exploitative, you know, in the 70s and, you know, even the 80s or whatever. But it feels like, you know, you said he's indulging in all of that. It feels very unapologetic. You know, yeah. It's not merely on display. He's hitting you over the head, which is kind of amazing. But, you know, it's funny that you say following the muse. Like, it occurs to me watching the movie. I mean, all of his movies are sort of fractured in a way chronologically and structurally, you know. I don't think he's ever adhered to the three act structure ever, has he?
No, or at least not in any traditional way. It's like you might get, you know, act one and then most of act three and then a lot of act two and then a little snippet that you missed from one. And then, you know, it's like, but that's part of why I love him. I mean, that's why I mean, ever since the beginning, the very first night that I remember being in, you know, at Real Movies in Cincinnati, Ohio in 1991 or whatever, where I first saw Reservoir Dogs. And then just like, this was, there was something so liberating about that, you know, that's part of what I loved about him ever since. And you certainly see that like magnified 100-fold in this movie. I mean, like he's right in, you know, he gets to the middle of the, it's like, it's two movies, you know, there's no act one. There's like, there's like an act one and then there's a kind of part of an act two. And then there's an act one again. There's like a, you know, it's like, it's, but to me, that's the freedom of that, especially when, you know, as a writer and people, when you're trying to break in, people tell you the rules all the time. You know, like if you want to break in, if you want to sell a script, if you want to be a writer, you have to do this, you know, your inciting incident has to be on this page and they have to save the cat by this page. And the turn into act one has to happen here and the turn in. And so just to watch somebody throw all that to the wind, you know, and for whatever success it is, people love the movie, people hate the movie. For me, it was just like, it was inspiring to watch somebody swing that big, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It is strange to note that. I mean, the film, I think, and I might be wrong about this, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think it's Tarantino's only fully chronologically told tale. I can't think of another one that is, you know, doesn't, you know, Death Proof doesn't have any sort of those strange digressions. It doesn't mess with it. I mean, structurally, it's weird, but it doesn't sort of hop back in time. We don't get any, you know, lengthy backstories for any of the characters. We don't get any cutaways. I mean, from the moment you begin that first half of the movie, you move forward through time, and then what happens happens, and then there's a reset, and then the same thing happens again, which is kind of strange, you know, looking at his entire filmography, that it sort of went that way.
Yeah, I never thought about that, and you're absolutely right. And that's the kind of crazy dichotomy, which is for the most sort of, you know, linear plot that he's constructed to this point, he did the craziest craziest like structural rule breaking that you can do. You know, I mean, that is kind of a weird dichotomy about this movie. I'd never really thought about it that way. You're absolutely right.
You know, I got to admit, I'd never considered it either until the rewatch last night. I watched it again, and it had been a couple of years since I'd seen it. But watching it again last night, it occurred to me halfway through, I was like, wait a second. This is all moving forward. We haven't jumped away or out of the timeline at any point. That's kind of crazy. So, you know,
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, what's also sort of strange about it is that so much of it is unfolding in real time, too. You know, not only is it moving forward, but you're sitting with these characters for long conversations. You know, it feels like you're there with them for, you know, 10, 15 minutes. Like, you're really hanging out with these people and you're getting to know them, and you're either compelled by them, you're getting to like them. And in certain cases, certain characters, like, you're developing a crush on them, you know, along the way. And it really feels like you're just sort of there hanging out for the night. So not only is it, you know, in linear fashion, but it's almost like, you know, like you're there in the moment.
Yeah. And I wonder how frustrating that must have been for certain people who did show up when that movie came out in 2007. You know, for the first half of Grindhouse, you get Planet Terror, which is the Rodriguez film. And it's like balls to the wall horror action, like, you know, would be John Carpenter movie. You know, loads of gore, loads of creature effects, you know, just God knows how many bullets are expended in that film.
Right.
And then you get, you know, you're an hour and a half in, you get those extra trailers, and then you get to Death Proof, which is like 90% dialogue.
Yeah.
And, you know, I loved it, but I'm partial to Tarantino anyway. Like, I could just listen to that man's dialogue, you know, for days. And I do remember, though, that there was sort of a backlash from the horror community when that movie came out. You know, so many people were pumped up at seeing Tarantino's version of a slasher film, you know, and then you get it and it's, well, again, it's 90% dialogue and there's no slashing. I mean,
right.
It almost felt like, in a way, like in the back of my mind, there were two fans duking it out inside of my head. You know, like, part of me was loving the new Tarantino movie and part of me was outraged that, you know, I had been sold something that I didn't quite get, you know, so.
Right. It was almost like he couldn't, there was a part of him even that couldn't go as far as he maybe was expected to go in the exploitation and the grindhouse of it all. You know, there was a part of that sort of played with the, you know, with the jump cuts and like the fake title at the beginning, you know, those, the flash frame title of Thunderbolt, you know, that kind of stuff. And, the
missing reel.
Yeah, exactly. The missing reel, like all that stuff. But when it came time to, you know, to tell the story, he couldn't help but be an artist about it too. Not to say that Rodriguez wasn't, but I think Rodriguez was having a little more fun with the tools at hand, you know?
Oh, sure. It felt like Rodriguez was sending up the idea of Grindhouse and was having so much fun and was throwing – it was a kitchen sink approach to celebrating, you know, not a genre, but, you know, the idea of the old Grindhouse movies, whereas Tarantino crafted something that I think probably would have been an actual Grindhouse film, you know, with
right.
With the exception of, like, you know, the use of cell phones in the movie. And I think one character mentions the, you know, the phrase CGI when talking about like car stunt work. Mm-hmm. With the exception of those two things, that movie could be a 70s film.
Well, you know what got me thinking about that? And I actually, as I was watching it, I started jumping online to look up a couple things. But there's a part of it, too, where Stuntman Mike is talking about the jobs that he did. You know, and his first job was for the Virginian. you know, being a stuntman for Gary Clark. And I was like, man, that's kind of a weird, you know, weird like anachronism, because I went and looked it up, and you know, the Virginian is from like early 1960s, which meant that Stuntman Mike is Kurt Russell's age. He would have been like 13 at the time when he was doing it, which if this had been a period piece, you know, if they had shot this in 1978, then that would have worked out. You know, that would have been okay. But it's kind of weird that he was in all these shows that nobody's ever heard about. He had to, you know, he would have been 10 years old driving these cars. But juxtaposed, like you said, against the cell phones and that kind of stuff too. So it's clearly like a modern story. But almost that is kind of like those sort of incongruous details is grindhousey in a, you know, its own way.
Oh, sure, absolutely. And I, you know, it's certainly sold with like, you know, the look and sort of the degradation of like the film print. You know, I'm certain he actually shot film, and I'm certain that Rodriguez probably shot digitally and, you know, did everything in post. But, right. You know, man, there's something about the movie, and I almost hesitate to say it, because once you notice it, you'll never unsee it. It'll take an extra viewing or two to sort of get used to it. But, and maybe you notice it straight away. I don't know. I didn't the first couple of times I saw it, but I'd remembered reading an interview a long time ago, right before the movie came out, where Tarantino said that he did something to the film visually, like, and somebody asked him, they were like, you can't possibly want us to do that or leave it that way or something. And I remember not being able to see it the first time. Of course, you know, me being one of the eight people who loved the movie and wanted to see it in theaters as often as possible, I think it was on my third or fourth viewing, I realized what it was, and it drove me crazy for the rest of the movie. And it's this: I worked as a projectionist in a movie theater, you know this, for a handful of years before I became a manager. And I still say that being a projectionist working with film is my favorite job I've ever had. But, you know, whenever a film got damaged, we would have clear splicing tape that we would repair the frames with, right? Now, whenever you would repair a splice, the tape would go directly over the cut, which means that half of the tape would go over the previous frame and half of the tape would go over the top half of the next frame, right? Mm-hmm. And if you knew to look for it, most people would never notice it because, you know, 24 frames a second, it goes by in, you know, faster than the blink of an eye. But it leaves a tiny line in the middle of the frame, two frames in a row. If you watch the first half of Death Proof, every single cut, has that black line.
Huh.
And the last frame of the cut and the frame, you know, that comes next. And I don't know what that's supposed to mean. I can only guess, like, are we meant to be watching like a work print version of this movie that they've salvaged or whatever, that there are so many tape splices? But yeah, the next time you watch it, I mean, again, it'll probably drive you insane and you can curse my name if it does, but it is there. Every time the camera reverses to a character, every time it cuts away, or every time it moves from a wide shot to a close up, you get that little like audio pop and then the line in the middle of the frame. And it's aggravating, but it also adds so much to the overall look of it, you know?
Well, like, the movie was made to sort of feel like it was discovered, you know, that actually was made in the 70s, other than those incongruous sort of modern details, but was like it was made to be a film that was discovered, that had been made back then and shown now. And it's almost like, you know, they didn't discover the, you know, the pristine print. They discovered the one that had been transported from drive-in to drive-in to drive-in. And at every one of those places, somebody at some point, you know, screwed up the projection. The film got stuck and they had to pull it apart. They had to cut it. They retaped it. And kind of what we're watching is like after the 2-year tour of Thunderbolt, you know, Death Proof.
Oh, totally. Oh, well, you know, it's crazy too. In addition to that, I mean, there are some weird audio flubs during mm-hmm. it where, you know, lines are repeated from one cut to the next. And then, you know, I swear to God, I had never noticed it. And all the times I've seen this movie, last night watching it again was the first time I noticed it, when, you know, the initial group of girls, you know, including Butterfly and, you know, Jungle Julia. And when they're at Guero's, the little Mexican place, there is like a wide shot of the table as they're talking, and then the camera reframes to somebody speaking as though there should have been a cutaway to another character as they were speaking. And instead they just didn't have that footage. So there's a weird, like, you see the camera sort of lilt to the side, like somebody is readjusting the, you know, the tripod. And then there's this really dirty zoom into the character who's going to speak next. And it's just, it's so much fun to watch stuff like that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's all the like the really loving little details. And that's just another level of that like obsession and the sort of fetishizing of all that stuff, too. I mean, that's like he went that deep with it. You know, it wasn't just the content. It wasn't just the dialogue. It wasn't just the acting. It was even in that like granular detail, too, which is, that's why the guy's an artist.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I love it for all of those little details. Yeah, all of his movies are usually similarly packed with attention to detail. I think this was the first time that, you know, he sort of celebrated what many people would consider mistakes. But just in doing it, it made it so much more fun. But, you know, the curious thing, though, is that for all of those mistakes, all of those flubs, all of the weird tape marks and the audio flubs and the really grainy look to the film, that's really only for the first half of the film when we're with the first group of girls. When the movie resets, you know, there is that that middle sequence with Michael Parks as Earl McGraw, you know, encoring from Kill Bill and From Dusk Till Dawn. He sort of gives this great psycho style expository, you know, explanation as to, you know, who Stuntman Mike is and what he gets out of all this, which will be fun to talk about in a second. But, you know, once you move past that sequence and you get to the second half with our new group of people, you know, we have Kim and Abernathy and Zoe and Lee. The movie is much cleaner. You know, there aren't the weird splice marks. There's like the occasional little thing to tie it back to the first half of the movie, like a little bit of a degradation of the print. You know, I think there's like an audio pop and a little bit of like scarring to the film later on. But for the most part, it's a much cleaner looking movie. And I don't think I ever considered up until the viewing last night why he did that. And it strikes me that, you know, both halves of that movie are two entirely different stories that are tied together by the villain. And the first movie is an exploitation film. You know, it's, you know, it sort of follows slasher tropes. You know, we're introduced to this core group of characters being stalked by a lurking madman. We have a final girl, you know, investigative gaze and all with Arlene, or Butterfly, as she's nicknamed, you know, who's sort of obviously meant to be our heroine. You know, drugs abound. There's sort of that promise of sex in the film, what with the guys who hang around with the girls, you know, just dying to get to that lakeside cabin the girls are meant to be heading to, which in itself is kind of a tease. You know, it sounds like the perfect setting for a slasher film finale, a lakeside cabin, even though we never make it there. And, you know, not unlike a lot of slasher films, you know, the first half of the movie has this sort of a leering gaze, you know, sort of objectifying the women at times. And I mean, you know, the movie opens with a shot of Arlene's feet, and we have practically a Texas Chainsaw style ass shot of Jungle Julia that serves as her introduction, you know. And, you know, there are the shots of like Arlene gyrating at the jukebox. There's that lap dance. And then, you know, there's Stuntman Mike, you know. And I think it was an old Fangoria, but I'd read somewhere where Tarantino basically said that Stuntman Mike's method of attack, you know, not slashing with a knife like a slasher villain, but using his car, you know, to kill the women, is in a way sort of a sexual attack. You know, that's Mike's way of raping those characters, you know, and it's hinted at again with that that monologue that Earl McGraw. Yeah, you know, he basically lays that all out. You know, it's that idea is floated that Stuntman Mike might be impotent. You know, one character notes later on that he must have a tiny dick because of his muscle car, you know. And, you know, we're maybe meant to think, I don't know, you know, is that what sort of fuels Mike's misogyny? You know, he does only target women, and it's kind of, it's icky. And, you know, all that sort of serves the style of this exploitative grindhousey sort of movie. But when it goes away in the second half of the movie, you know, and the film print is cleaned up and looks better, the male gaze there is sort of less obvious. The female leads are older and stronger characters. They even get their own muscle cars, you know, at that point. But it's curious that when our characters change and the goals of the movie change, then visually he sort of supports that too by pulling back everything that we associate with being, well, grindhouse or exploitation, you know?
Well, and if you look at in terms of, you know, like the atmosphere of both halves of the story too, I mean, the first half of the story starts in the daytime, but it's very quickly night, and then it's like very rainy and night, and that, you know, like the second bar they go to is just drenched in rain and you know, sort of pounding down on Mike's car, and it's all, and the attack itself, all that stuff happens at night. And there's something too about like the sort of relationship between the girls. It's a little more antagonistic. It's a little more It feels a little, you know, the humor is a little more biting. It's just feels a little darker all around. They're sort of, you know, Jungle Julia is pining for the, you know, the director. She's out sending him these texts, and there's almost like not a sadness underneath it too, but there's definitely something that feels a little darker and heavier. And then when it gets to that second half of the movie, it's sunny. There's color, you know, like, you know, Mary Elizabeth Winstead's her, you know, her costume is this like bright yellow cheerleader costume. The girls are having much more fun with each other and laughing and telling these great stories. And it's clear they have this like long term affection for each other. And they're really driving the story, too. You know, like Zoe is, she's the one that, you know, throws down the gauntlet. I want to drive. You know, Kowalski, I want to drive the car from Vanishing Point. They go, you know, run this con on the, you know, on the redneck and go off and do this. And the whole thing happens in the daytime. So it's almost even like, you know, atmospheric. And to me, it almost gives a sense of like the filmmaker who that almost sort of in the grindhouse of it too, that maybe they were two different movies and or either they were meant to be one movie and the filmmaker ran out of money after making the first half, you know, and then like 2 years later was able to scrounge up and make it, you know, like make a little more higher quality version of the second half of the story. Or, you know, at some point some distributor was like, you know, I really like the first half of Thunderbolt and I really like the second half of, you know, of Death Proof. Let's cut those both together. We'll slap a little, like a Roger Corman thing. We'll slap a little paste in the middle with this McGraw scene and we'll re-release it as one movie, you know?
And that's totally something Corman would have done.
Right. Totally repurpose all this footage, you know, like maybe even, you know, that McGraw scene was from a whole, but by the way, that McGraw scene has my favorite line in the whole movie. And I laugh every time I hear it when he says, it looked like a goddamn giant chewed him up and spit him out. is possibly the best, maybe only the second, maybe only second to Eli Roth. I was like, dude, cut himself falling out of his time machine. You know, that line, which I always makes me laugh too.
Oh God. Yeah. It's, God, so many great lines, so much fantastic dialogue in that movie. His, honestly, I, you know, I love the stories that he tells, but if I'm being honest, the thing that makes me giddy about seeing a new Tarantino movie every time out is just what the man's dialogue is going to be like. And there's certainly, yeah, I mean, if this is his worst film still being, you know, pretty fantastic. God, his dialogue is still aces in it, you know. But, you know, I guess that's an interesting point, though, about the first half of the movie. It sort of follows those horror tropes, you know, it being a dark and stormy night with everybody hanging out at the bar. And, you know, the second half is much sunnier, you know.
Yeah.
And the girls definitely get the upper hand, which is kind of great. And, you know, it's weird that Stuntman Mike is almost two different characters, too. You think about him in the first half of the movie. He's fucking super cool, man.
Yeah.
Like, he's... We know from the very beginning, the first time we see him, when Arlene does the final girl look, figuring out that something is amiss, you know, he's in that car stalking them. He's obviously the villain, but he's got that swagger. You know, he's got great dialogue. He's Kurt friggin' Russell. And, you
right.
know, but it's strange that he kind of holds to some of the tropes of like those old slashers in a way. I mean, you know, he's a teetotaler, so he doesn't drink. He refuses an offer of weed. You know, he seems to have no major interest in sex, at least, you know. Not conventionally, so far as all the girls surrounding him are concerned, you know, for that, he's essentially like Michael Myers or Jason Voorhees, except he has like a, you know, he has a personality, but, you know, we kind of like him in a way until he does what he does. But in the second half, he sort of recedes into the background to do his thing, you know, where he stalks and he lurks about and we see him sort of putting his plan into motion, which we're now privy to, you know, in the background. And it sort of, we're nervous about it, but then, you know, he goes from being a cool guy to being a threatening guy until he's shot in the arm and chased by our heroines, at which point he becomes, forgive me, please, but he becomes a complete pussy,
which absolutely.
Which is glorious. You know, we love seeing that misogynist murderous jackass not only get his comeuppance, but to completely devolve into like this simpering mess in the process. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I agree. He's one of those guys. It's that the entrance of that character is something that I feel like, especially like as an actor, and you have somebody like Kurt Russell who's playing it too. But just the fact that he's sitting there at this bar and he's digging into this huge plate of nachos, and just you know that it's like the messiest kind of like the biggest drippiest kind of thing, and he's just scarfing them down, and it reminds me of. you know, in the Tennessee Williams play, Streetcar Named Desire, like that character Stanley that the Marlon Brando played, you know, there's always a big sort of like thing about he made his entrance carrying this piece of bloody meat, you know, and you kind of knew who that guy was right away from that. But then you look at Stuntman Mike and he's got this clearly like icy hot jacket that is definitely out of some like promotional thing or some evil Knievel thing he did. You know, and he's sitting there just like shoveling down this plate of nachos, and he's so likable, like you said, from the beginning. And you could tell that with too, with Rose McGowan's character, there's something about him, even though he is a little bit of that like creepy guy at the bar, who's a little, who, you know, a little too sure of himself, but definitely a little compelling and a little alluring. You could see her too, you know, that there's something about her that she's drawn to him, and hell, I would be too. And he's funny, you know, the fact that like his brother's name is Stuntman Bob, that kind of stuff. Like I would have gotten in the car with that dude. Are you kidding me? And especially like if you told me that this car was like death proof and that these stuntmen made it together, put it together for him, and you know, that kind of thing. That to me is like is all great stuff right up to that turn. And another thing I love about those early scenes, and like you mentioned about the teetotaling and the marijuana and all that stuff, it's sort of like quirky details as you're going along, as you're watching the scene. These little details are embedded in. And I never drink. I'm ordering a virgin pina colada, and all that stuff is kind of like fun and quirky, you know, for the character. And then you get to that scene with McGraw, and that you realize it was all part of the plan. You know, the fact that he didn't have alcohol in his system, and yeah, these girls did. Not only were they, you know, not only were they drinking, they, you know, had weed, and now and Pam Rose McGowan's character, like she's the one that asked him for the ride, and all that kind of stuff. That it was like, you know, it's all stuff that allowed him to walk away scot free, even though McGraw knew exactly what he was up to.
Yeah, I always wondered too. I wonder what. We don't need to know, obviously, and it's not like there's ever going to be a prequel or sequel, but, you know, one wonders what Mike's deal was as far as, like, did he travel the country pulling the same thing? Because the movie begins in Texas, and then we eventually wind up in Tennessee. It's like, is he racking them up state by state? You know, has he done this before? You know?
Well, also what I was wondering, too, is he following movie crews? You know, because but that just factors into both halves of the movie, which is, you know, in the
holy
first half,
shit,
there is a movie crew
I'd never
in town. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that either till last night. I was like, is he following around movie productions? Is he, you know, is he a guy that's like and also because he certainly meets his match with stunt people on the second half of the movie. So maybe that's part of it, too.
Huh. I don't think I'd ever considered that. That's kind of fascinating. Yeah, because we have the I don't know who it's supposed to be. I mean, maybe Richard Linklater with it being Austin, but, you know, the Christian Simonson character in Texas, you know, that Jungle Julia is, you know, is chasing after. But yeah, there was totally a movie being filmed there. And then in Tennessee, it's, oh, God, whoever it is, not The Rock, but.
yeah. Which The Rock, I got to tell you, and one of the things I learned on Extant was, you know, The Rock is a real person, and he's actually a big guy. I think he's on Electric's crew, and he looks like The Rock, and really handsome dude, big, strong guy. And I got to talking with him one day. I think it was like the second day of shooting the pilot for Extant, and just introduced myself to him, and we started talking, and he told me, he's like, yeah, I'm usually on, you know, on Tarantino's crews, and he'd been off shooting Hateful Eight. And I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. And then he's like, yeah. Remember when they're talking about The Rock? He's like, that's me. so that's my little claim to fame, is I'd actually worked with The Rock, although he never grabbed me and kissed me from behind, like he did. Thank God. that would have been inappropriate on set, but, that was a very cool thing. But hey, I want to jump back to that, the sort of dialogue for a second, because it occurs to me too, like, that same thing about Mike, you know, talking about the sort of quirky details of that scene of him not ordering the drinks and that being a plot point later, is so beautifully set up in the diner scene, too. They have this whole conversation about how Zoe is death proof, essentially, you know, that the Zoe is, she's the cat. She can survive anything. And it's like this really fun, funny conversation. And it really comes to play later. So that moment when Zoe pops up in the weeds, I'm okay. and Rosario Dawson's character is like, of course you are. You know, Abernathy's just like, you're Zoe the cat. And you buy it, you know, in that sense, because of how it was set up. And I think it goes to that old I don't know if it was Robert McKee or somebody too, that old rule of like, you know, exposition is ammunition. And you don't think that you're learning something that's going to play a major part later. And I mean, he's so great at that. That's one of the things I think he's just always been a master of from the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I it's funny. I don't think I'd ever considered before that the title of the movie Death Proof might well refer to Zoe rather than, you know, Stuntman Mike's car.
I believe that 100%. Even if he didn't mean that, I 100% believe that the title is really about her. Because at the end of the day, it means, and she is, you know, she's just as death proof as that car.
Yeah, I'm kind of amazed. Like when he wrote her that part and she was in that movie, like I got to attribute part of it to the fact that the movie didn't do very well, but that should have been like a star making role for her, you know, because she's so damn good. And what's crazy is if you look at her filmography, I mean, she certainly worked since as not only as a stunt woman, but, you know, as an actress. But it's funny. There are movies like, I think she did an action film that she led called Angel of Death. And then she did a movie a couple of years ago called Rays, which is actually pretty good, even if it's kind of a ripoff of Joe Lansdale's short story, The Pit. But, you know, in both movies and actually several times in several movies I've seen her in since Death Proof, it's funny that they always seem to focus on the action aspect of her, like the fact that she's a stunt woman. And even though it's awesome to see her on the hood of that Challenger in the final half of the movie, and even though, you know, when she's wielding that big, pipe, you know, she's truly intimidating and she's a complete badass. The reason we love her in that movie isn't any of that. It's the fact that she's so damn charming. And it seems like nobody's capitalized on that until Tarantino had to do it again with The Hateful Eight when she isn't playing, you know, what was her name in that Six Horse? I can't remember her name, but
I can't either.
You know, that's not an action role at all, but she's, you instantly love her in The Hateful Eight. And it occurs to me that people just aren't using her in the way that they probably should as an actress. And I kind of hope that somebody eventually, like, other than Tarantino, finds a way to put her as the lead in a movie and sort of let her shine in the way that he does, you know?
Yeah, you know, we're like a TV show. I mean, to me, this is not that I'd want it to be like this, but like, what's her version of Walker, Texas Ranger? You know, it's like the weekly adventure that she can go on where we get to see her be her, you know, as charming and as super cool as she is. And then at some point she has to like beat somebody's ass. You know, I think that to me, I'd be down every week for that.
That should be the Walker, Texas Ranger reboot where it's his daughter who just happened to be raised in New Zealand, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's Walker, Auckland Ranger. Exactly.
But it's great. You know, as completely badass as she is in that second half, she's also surrounded by like other really great characters. Like Rosario Dawson is awesome as Abernathy. And, you know, is it Tracy Toms who plays Kim is amazing. Yeah. You know, they're all like these, you know, arguably Lee, played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead, isn't necessarily that strong of a character, but the movie also sort of leaves her behind at a certain point too. But, I just remember I was lucky enough to go to a comic book convention back in 2004, like God forever ago. But, they had like this media section before the same convention eventually became like a pop culture con rather than just comic books. But David Carradine was there and I had him sign my Kill Bill poster and he signed it. It's a chick flick. And looking at Death Proof is kind of a chick flick too, in a way, not a traditional one, but, you know, it totally seems like it'd be a chick flick. And it makes me think about like Tarantino's filmography in a way, how, you know, that guy often writes like strong female characters that he usually puts through hell, but, you know, sort of rewards them by, you know, by the end. You know, I'm thinking of like Jackie Brown or, you know, the bride from Kill Bill or Zoe in the gang from Death Proof or even Broomhilda, arguably, in Django Unchained, you know, and I don't think that Tarantino really gets much credit in that regard. Usually people just knock him for the violence in his films, but I don't think even post Kill Bill that people really give him credit for writing strong female protagonists in his, you know, in his stuff.
Yeah, I certainly would agree. And I got to imagine like if you're an actress who gets one of those scripts and you open it up and you see a character like Abernathy or you see a character like the bride that you just, man, I mean, how lucky do you feel? Cause you just don't get to do those types of things as often as you should, you know? And he's a guy who's who's putting it out there all the time. And certainly, like I said, with Jackie Brown, I mean, to me, that was that's still, you know, it's funny because we're talking about his filmography, and that's one that's just sort of like the older that I get creeps higher and higher up the list, you know, and it might actually be in second place for me now next to Pulp Fiction, which I think Pulp Fiction is always going to hold the top spot of my heart. It's my favorite movie of all time.
Same here.
Just see, is it for you too? That's so funny.
It's totally my favorite Tarantino. It's weird. I have like this revolving list of top movies. Like if I were to give somebody my top 10, there would be like four number ones and then like, you know, five through 10. Right. But yeah, Pulp is definitely in that top four.
What I think, and just jump back to this movie too, where we're talking about like the female characters in this. There are two really distinct groups of girls and different personalities and different and all different types. And they're, I mean, you've got Jungle Julia, who's such a great character, who's so he's just so, you know, sharp and super cool. And like nothing phases her. And I mean, all those are great. Even Lena Frank, you know, like I was like, I want to hang out with Lena Frank at the end of this. But but Abernathy, to me, she's like the most valuable player. And there's a moment, you and I've talked about this before, but it's my favorite moment in the whole movie. It's the moment that makes the movie for me, which is when they're playing Ship's Mast, and Abernathy sort of, you know, like had to kind of, you know, weasel her way in to come along for the ride. And it's this really crazy thing that's happening, and Kim makes her get in the front, and you could tell she's terrified of what's going on. And there's that great shot of her. This, you know, close up, it sort of pushes in closer and closer to her, and Rosario Dawson, she plays it so beautifully on her face, where you can see that shift from terror to just like complete exhilaration and fun, you know, and that shift happens. You can see it in her eyes. He shot it so great. And so to me, and then Stuntman Mike shows up to ruin it all. And so to me, that is like Abernathy is the MVP from the. And I think this was like one of a string of movies right in a row that made Rosario Dawson one of my favorite actors. Like, you know, Clerks 2 was around at the same time and a bunch of great performances from her. Sin City. Yeah. I mean, she was like she could do no wrong.
Yeah, I agree. I got to ask before I explain to the audience who's listening what we're talking about. Do you still have the film trimming or the film clip?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I got it in a problem somewhere. What I've never done is find a way to display it properly. So that's still on my list to do.
Rock on. Okay, for listeners out there, I no longer work at the theater that I used to, so I figure I'm probably okay with going ahead and spilling something that I used to do. Back in the day, I think it was around 2004, 2005, there was a television series that Showtime did called Masters of Horror, and there was an episode that John Carpenter directed called Cigarette Burns, and there was a film projectionist who collected film frames out of the prints that he would project before he sent them on. And I remember seeing that and thinking, hey, I'm a projectionist. I like movies. I could probably do this. So for my very favorite films, I would find my very favorite moments and I would trim no more than six frames in these little slips or whatever. And if a friend would ask for a moment, I would usually pull one of those too. It only made the film print a little grindhouseier as it was. So in this case, I remember Mickey talking about that moment. So I actually went through the film print, that reel, frame by frame, and I found not just a shot of Rosario Dawson, but I tried to find the very moment where her look of terror shifted to the very beginning of a smile and tried to capture that in six frames before I clipped it out. So somewhere out there, there's a 35mm film print of Grindhouse that's missing that moment. I apologize if anybody saw it at a sub-run theater after. That's my fault, but... you know, what are you going to do? But
my hope would be that he would approve.
Yeah, I would hope. Or maybe he would give me hell. I don't know. Maybe all of the 35mm film prints go back to him. I got to imagine that's true. But God, dude, I miss film. I miss working with film. I miss projecting film. Now that everything's digital, I'm just kind of bummed. But that's a rant for another time. But, you know, it's... It's funny, though, that you said that like Pulp Fiction is your favorite movie of all time, which I, you know, like I said, it's one of mine, too. I adore that movie. But it's strange. You can't talk with larger groups of people about Tarantino without finding at least one person that dislikes him. You know, he can be like it's strange that he's such a polarizing figure for film fans. You know, there are people that I know, like friends of the show, who maintain that the guy is nothing more than like a ripoff artist, you know, not an artist at all, really, but because of how much he lifts from other movies. So what's sort of your response to people who have that sort of opinion about Tarantino, you know, being a fan of the man? Yeah. And I'll let you go first. I mean, I got to imagine, you know, we fall on the same side of the fence so far as the man goes, I believe. But, you know, what do you think about like all the charges that he contends with that he is, you know, just a ripoff artist, as it were?
I mean, I don't buy that at all. I think that he's certainly influenced by a guy. He's a guy who wears his influences on his sleeve, but I don't think that he's in that way. He's any different than so many other great artists throughout history. I mean, it was even, you know, Picasso has that great quote about good artist copy, great artist steal. And I think that, you know, if you look at anybody along the way, if you look at Steven Spielberg, I mean, Spielberg is there, even things later in his career. Like if you look at, you know, things like War Horse or Lincoln, like there are things that he's going back and he's mining those guys, like, you know, Hawks and John Ford and people like that, and you know, going back and looking at them and using them as inspiration for what he's doing now. And to me, it's the way that he combines all those elements into his own sensibility and brings them something new from himself, and also to me, like the mastery of the craft, the way that you blend all that stuff together, that counts for something. And it's not, and like I said, and certainly the older he gets in the newer films, they're not shallow. They're about something too. I mean, at the, you know, first and foremost, they're just really freaking entertaining, but you know, these later movies, actually they have something to say about the world too.
Yeah, I agree entirely. And, you know, I read somewhere, somebody put it better than I could at the time. It was ages ago. But, you know, they basically pointed out that they thought that Tarantino's work is still vital and still legitimate because, you know, he isn't merely copying other filmmakers. You know, the elements that he lifts from other movies, you know, he sort of synthesizes into his own personal vision, you know. So, you know, I mean, Reservoir Dogs owes a lot to City on Fire, sure, but it isn't just a City on Fire retread, you know. Django Unchained may owe a lot to Django and many other spaghetti westerns, but it's doing something entirely different with those ideas and tropes. And, you know, you look at Kill Bill and all the movies he touches on, he's still doing his own thing. Just, you know, the fact that the bride wears Bruce Lee's jumpsuit doesn't mean that the movie is a remake of that old Bruce Lee flick, you know?
Right, exactly. And I think that, I mean, that to me, that stuff is so silly because it's, and I know, you know, myself as a writer, I'm sure you know this too. Like, I know when I'm writing something, and there's an idea that springs up and I know exactly where it came from. You know, like I know that this is the Amblin child in me who is like really seeing this moment. This is the guy who loves the Twilight Zone. This is the guy who's channeling Rod Serling in this moment. And I'm not consciously like going back to steal something. I'm not looking at my DVD shelf and saying, Kronos was a great movie. Let me pull a scene from that. And this is not how it works, but you're like, I think if you're doing your job as an artist, you're living your life, you're consuming great art too, or you're consuming anything like, you know, movies, books, TV, graphic novels, paintings, you know, life experience, all this stuff goes into one giant well. And if you're doing your job right, you sit down, you tap into that well and all these things come out, you know, they come spilling out of you and they can't help but spill out of you because they've meant something to you and then that you're going to pass them on and mean something to, and they're going to mean something to somebody else. And so in that way, I think he's doing the job that he always should have done. And, you know, I don't know how anybody does it any other way, actually.
And plus, being fair to Tarantino, too, like, you know, he always points out what his influences are. You know, he always shines a light on the things that he's drawing from. There are great movies that are little seen that I would have no idea exist. You know, one of my favorite movies of all time is Rolling Thunder. I would have no idea that movie existed if it weren't for Tarantino. And I'm sure it's the case for like dozens of other movies that I've seen and loved, you know? So it's not like he's trying to pull one over on audiences and he's trying to steal and pass it off of his own. He's obviously always very vocal about what he sort of pulls, you know, and what his influences are, I think, anyway.
Yeah, I would agree. And I mean, I have that same experience. I mean, there's a reason that I went to the video store and started renting all the old John Woo stuff, you know, 20 years ago. You know, that's the reason I saw The Killer and Hard Boiled and Better Tomorrow. It's the reason I started reading Carl Hyacin and Elmore Leonard. Like he was a conduit to all that stuff for me, and not because you know, he'd copied them, but because I knew that those were his influences, you know. And it's kind of like, to me, it's sort of one of the great things I love to do is as a, you know, as a writer, as a filmmaker too, which is like you find somebody that you love and you find out who their influences are and you go back and look at all that stuff. And then you find out who influenced them and you keep looking further and further back. And it's like, you know, it's, I think that's how you educate yourself as a filmmaker, as a writer.
I agree. And, you know, talking about Tarantino for just, you know, a second more, you just mentioned Rod Serling a second ago, and you mentioned back at the beginning of the show the fact that you might have at one point wanted to choose three episodes of The Twilight Zone to talk about because we're both huge Serling nerds. And I remember when you had pointed that out and you eventually went to Death Proof, we talked about what Serling might have thought of Tarantino if he were still alive and if he viewed Tarantino's stuff. Because, you know, on the one hand, when you think of Tarantino's work, there is inevitably the sort of violence that comes along with his movies. And, you know, you think about all of the movies that were inspired by Tarantino in the late 90s, everyone always assumed that Tarantino's work was a bit cynical and a little too cool or whatever. But I don't know, what are your feelings on what Serling, who seemed to be a great humanist in a way, like what he would have made of Tarantino's work?
I mean, I definitely feel like he would have been all in with the later stuff. You know, I think that he would have definitely because he had, like you said, because of his humanist side, because those social issues were so important to him. And that was such a part of the DNA of the Twilight Zone. And I think that he would love those. But there's a part of me that also wonders if the earlier stuff that he would have found exploitative in some way, because there was a great lecture by him, and you might have actually given me this lecture for my birthday that I listened to. But, you know, like, he found Hogan's Heroes perverse, you know, because it was like taking because it was setting a comedy in you know, Nazi Germany, and that there was just like, he found very little humor in that, you know. So there's a part of me that sort of wonders about what he would think about something like Bastards, Inglourious Bastards, which, you know, on one hand is kind of great because it goes back and rewrites history, and it certainly has something to say underneath. But it also is sort of mining some dark humor out of it too. And I don't know. What do you think?
I think I would have a hard time imagining Serling watching something like Reservoir Dogs and enjoying it, where there's sort of, you know, there is that ultra violence and there is sort of a gallows humor and a sort of, you know, there's a phrase I remember Serling saying at one point, like a cheapening of life, you know, when it comes to fiction. You know, I love Reservoir Dogs, but when you watch it, like, it is a great character study in a way, and it is a lot of fun to watch, but ultimately it doesn't, God, this sounds like I'm knocking the movie and I'm really not, but it ultimately doesn't amount to a great deal more than the story it's telling, you know, but I imagine him sitting down to watch something like Pulp Fiction where, yeah, everything is sort of non-chronological in a way. Everything is chopped up and there is still a great deal of violence, but all of those stories, all of those little sections that Tarantino is telling in that way, they all end in a sort of redemption for those characters. And I got to imagine that Serling would have responded to that in some way. I would hope so anyway.
Yeah. And there was a code and a sort of morality, you know, to it by the end, certainly.
And I mean, Jackie Brown too is just, I can't imagine anybody not liking Jackie Brown. I don't understand him if they don't.
I think that would have been his favorite.
But yeah, no, I see what you're saying though. I see what you're saying rather with the, you know, movies like Django Unchained or The Hateful Eight, you know, there are certainly other levels at play there that I think Serling would have responded to and I think would have appreciated. I would hope anyway, you know, who's to say? I mean, I'm just a fan of the guy, but it is an interesting question to ask and a funny one that just sort of cropped up over, you know, what your choice was going to be for this talk. But
when, you know what, also just one more, just throw a more little thing in there too, is he was certainly a guy who appreciated a good comeuppance, you know? So anytime these characters, like, you know, people that are ultimately hoisted on their own petard, I think there's so much of that, like in, you know, in Django and Bastards and all those things too, where I think that, just the justice of, you know, of all that kind of stuff might have enjoyed a little bit of the thirst for blood there.
Might have cackled a little bit at where Hans Landa winds up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
In spite of himself, might have giggled at Hitler getting machine gunned. Who knows?
Who knows? Too bad he's not around for us to ask.
Think of all the years we lost with that guy. He died at, was it age 50, I think?
Yeah, he was pretty young, early 50s, if not 50.
Not cool. Not cool. Eesh. All right. You know, watching this movie again last night, it occurred to me there are so many moments in it that sort of nod back not only to other films, but his own films in a way, in a fun way. Like, he has built his own sort of, you know, cinematic universe in a way long before Marvel ever came along by just referencing things like, well, in Death Proof, I think Big Kahuna Burger is brought up. But, you know, for like, I got to imagine he writes stuff. Maybe he's unaware of it. Maybe he's just repeating certain things. You know, I'm reminded of that video that points out all of the recurring phrases in all of Aaron Sorkin's stuff. You know, maybe that's the case with Tarantino, but, you know, there are moments in Death Proof, like, you know, Tarantino himself saying post time as he slams down a drink, which isn't unlike Clooney in From Dusk Till Dawn, or, you know, just a moment later, he's like, is that a tasty beverage or is that a tasty beverage? You know, you got Michael Park showing up again as Earl McGraw. You have his son showing up as his son again, who had popped up in Kill Bill and the From Dusk Till Dawn sequel. You have Marley Shelton popping up again as Dr. Block from the previous Grindhouse installment, Planet Terror. Like, in the same movie, they're set in the same world, even though it doesn't even make a whole hell of a lot of sense that,
right,
you know, Death Proof is kind of a sequel to Planet Terror, but Planet Terror ends with the end of the world. So how the hell does that work? But, you know, you got to, I think Abernathy's ringtone is the Twisted Nerve whistling theme, you know, used so prominently in Kill Bill. But,
right.
But, you know, there was something that you had pointed out a long time ago when we watched it, too. Like, there are even stylistic choices that sort of echo his earlier works. Like, you know, I'm thinking about that final chase scene when the three gals are chasing Mike down to kill him. And it's all like just fury and, you know, loud noises and the cars roaring and Kim screaming. And then it cuts to a peaceful wide shot where the two cars are far in the distance and you can barely hear them. And in the foreground is just like this, you know, large well pump or something.
Yeah, you know? It's like an oil derrick or something. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it completely recalls that that moment from Kill Bill, the Oren Ishii fight, where it's the same thing. You know, the swords are clanging against each other and, you know, everything is super dramatic and it's all done in quick cuts where they're fighting furiously. And then it cuts to a wide shot where they're in the foreground and you have that weird pond just sitting and trickling peacefully. And, you know, I wonder if he does that consciously or if that's just, you know, something that he likes to revisit from movie to movie or when it, you know, occurs to him.
Yeah. I was wondering that same thing last night, cause I was reminded of that same moment as I was watching it. And now I think in the years since, you know, I've seen that moment in you know, quite a few other, certainly like a few other martial arts movies too. It's like that, you know, that sort of moment in between the, you know, where they're standing in the rain and the raindrops are bouncing off the sword while they're waiting, you know, that kind of stuff too. It's that little breath of quiet in the middle of this. But what makes it so great in Kill Bill is the fact that it's just like these two crazy muscle cars, you know, come roaring into frame from the end of it too, which it's just taking that sort of the old trope and applying a new point of view to it, which I think is really cool.
Yeah. And well, there's also that sequence too in the second half when we, I think after the girls pick up Zoe at the airport, they go to a diner and they talk. And it feels like it's this one lengthy discussion where the camera is constantly prowling around the outside of them. And while watching it, it's like, you know, this is like the female version of the opening of Reservoir Dogs.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. It reminds me of that exactly, although it's a little more like I was going to say a little more fun, but that one in Reservoir Dogs is pretty fun too. But yeah, even the way he shot it. And what's interesting about that is, like, as I was watching it last night, I was thinking, I'm surprised we didn't see this more somewhere in between, because that did become kind of like, it was so iconic in Reservoir Dogs, and he never really went back to it until this movie, right?
I don't think so. Not that I can recall. I mean, certainly there are lengthy sequences of dialogue like throughout all of his movies, but nothing like that I can think of. You know, everyone sitting around a table, you know, in close quarters as the camera sort of prowls around them.
You know what I love? Just to jump back to the cars and the oil derrick thing for a second too, which is that the weapons in that scene too, and it kind of speaks to stuntman Mike and Tarantino's version of a slasher movie. Which is like all those great the great villains have their weapon, you know, and you know, Freddy has his claws and Jason has his machete and, you know, Michael Myers, they all have their own iconic weapon. And Stuntman Mike is, you know, his weapon is his car. And so to have that breath of silence in between this, you know, battle of these two weapons, but just the fact that the two weapons in this are these crazy muscle cars, it's such a great little flip on that old trope.
Oh, totally. I agree. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, maybe if the movie had done better, I doubt it. I mean, I can't imagine Tarantino either doing a follow-up to one of his movies or allowing somebody else to do it without him. But sadly, unlike all of those horror icons, you know, Freddy, Jason, Michael Myers, all of them, Leatherface, we will never get another Stuntman Mike movie, you know?
No.
Which is, it's kind of sad. Like, I would even, you know, if this were back in the heyday of like the Dimension straight to video era, like the late 90s and early aughts, when everything that they did theatrically genre wise was getting sequelized and straight to DVD titles, you know, I would even be cool with, you know, if they had done direct to DVD sequels of the movies. They probably wouldn't have been good, but, you know, imagine, I don't know, like Bruce Campbell as Stuntman Bob, you know, the angry brother. Just, you know, and, you know, the car stunts wouldn't have been as impressive and the dialogue wouldn't have been as good. But damn it, I would have shown up for every one of them.
One, you know, like, but I think that he kind of ruined that at the end, too, with, like you were saying before, where Stuntman Mike is so emasculated and he's like crying and whimpering as he's pouring alcohol on his on his wound. And he's like, do it. You know, like all this stuff. Like, we never would have seen him as scary again. You know, like he never could have come back and been as menacing as he was in the opening of this movie after that.
Oh, my God. I'd like to think that that scene exists in the world of every slasher movie where after they're done doing whatever they do, like imagine the end of Halloween, you know, Sam Loomis shoots Michael Myers 6 times. He flies, or 7 times if you count the beginning of Halloween 2. You know, he flies off that balcony, he lands in the grass, and then Loomis goes chasing after him. And at the beginning of the next movie, he's off killing again. But I'd like to think that there was 5 minutes where Michael Myers pulled himself into an alleyway somewhere. It was just like, fuck! Damn it!
And he was like, come on, Mike, you got this. You got this. You can do this. You can do this, Mike.
He starts pulling out the bullets.
Yeah, you would never see that. Or Freddy, like, in the mirror before, and you got to psyching himself up. Like, come on, Freddy. Come on, you can do this. You got this, man.
I want to see this scene now in any horror movie going forward, even if they're ghosts. Could you imagine, like, a J-horror with, like, a long-haired Asian ghost, like, looking into the mirror? Just, you know, it's like that scene from Raging Bull or, you know, at the end of Boogie Nights where it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would love it.
The other movie with in Reservoir Dogs with Tim Roth's character, where he's like looking at himself in the mirror. He's like, "You're super cool. They don't know anything." He just wants to see them, like, psyching themselves up for the big scare. That would be so great.
I want to make this as a short film now. I don't know which slasher to pick, but I want to do this.
Yeah, definitely.
You're totally right, though. Yeah, that's great. You know, one of just to touch on one thing here for a second, it occurred to me watching it again last night. I always have an issue with this moment. Not an issue. It sounds like I have a problem with it. Not really. But I forget about it by the movie's end until, you know, I watch the movie again eventually. I've had this problem since 2007 when I first saw the movie. But when Stuntman Mike finally starts to attack the girls at the end, you know, you have Zoe on the hood of the car hanging on for dear life, right? She's even saying, like, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. I don't want to die. So obviously she fears for her life at that point. The girls are freaking out inside of the car. Stuntman Mike is purely lethal at this point. When he pulls alongside their car and he's screaming at them, yelling whatever, Zoe looks over to him for a second and screams, "Look out." And he looks ahead and sees a car in his oncoming lane, and he whips his car out of the way to keep from crashing headfirst into it. She essentially, a man who she's certain is going to end her life and who she is certain she's going to end his life, not 5 or 10 minutes later. There's a moment where she saves his life by telling him to look out or pay attention and to see he's about to crash headfirst into a car. And I've always wondered what that was supposed to mean. You know, was it just a knee-jerk reaction like you would tell anybody that? Was she sort of out of her head at that point and it was sort of just, you know, something she felt she had to say? Are we to believe that she's so decent a person that she's willing to save the life of the person who's still, you know, mortally threatening her? Like, how do you feel about that moment?
Yeah, I don't know. I noticed that same thing as I was watching it again, too, because it immediately cuts away to a shot of him veering out of the way of that car. I think you see it from behind at that point, too. And I had that same reaction. There was for a moment I was like, is that another, you know, sort of the Grindhouse touch where that was the actress in the, that was the stunt person in the scene, you know, and they kept her showing that too, but it's a little too meta for, you know, for what that probably was. But yeah, I don't know. That is a strange moment there because it does seem like she saves his life. I mean, the other version of it too, the other possibility is that she was saying it for Kim, you know, in that moment too. But yeah, I don't know.
It is curious, though, a movie I've seen, like, God, probably half a dozen, who am I kidding, probably a dozen times at this point. You know, it's nearly 10 years old, which is insane to think this movie's nearly got a decade on it. But, you know, it's fun to revisit this and still find new things and things that sort of disturb in that way or, you know, be enlightened about other aspects of it. And, you know, I can't think of many movies like this, you know, set in this genre that do much the same, you know, certainly not anything that dives so headfirst into the Grindhouse aesthetic. You know, like I said, we had all of those movies that followed up the big theatrical Grindhouse that sort of touched on that. And I think you said it once, we were watching a movie that sort of embraced the Grindhouse aesthetic and you leaned over at one point and you're like, you know, I've come to the conclusion that most of these movies that use the word Grindhouse are just trying to cover up the fact that they're a shitty film. But
I will take it.
But you know, but Death Proof, I mean, I think it is because Tarantino had a little more on his mind than just doing crass exploitation. You know, that's the reason that the movie still perseveres, even though it doesn't have a huge following, and even though the movie wasn't nearly as successful as it should have been. It's great to revisit and see that it's still, so far as I'm concerned, a pretty damn good film. But I don't know, man. What are your final thoughts on the movie? If you were to recommend this to somebody who either had never seen it before or who had seen it and didn't care for it so much the first time around, how would you sell them on this film?
You know, I think I would tell them, one, I would set their expectations. I think I would say, look, you're going to watch this movie. It's called Death Proof. It's got this crazy car. It's got Kurt Russell as a slasher who you know, uses a pimped out muscle car to kill people. And that sounds awesome. And it sounds like you're going to see a lot of that, but you're not. You know, but what you are going to get, are you going to get these great character stories about, you know, about these friendships and stuff. You know what I might liken it to a little bit is you know, sort of my favorite example of this is Man on Fire. You know, Man on Fire spends a lot of time building up the relationship between, you know, Denzel and the girl, who is it, Dakota Fanning?
Yes.
You know, it spends a lot of time building that up so that when, like, the shit really hits the fan, like, you're really invested in that too. And I think that he really takes the time in each of those halves of the movies. It's almost like he's got it when he restarts the movie, he's got to reset again with you as an audience to reinvest in those girls. But I feel like so one, I would prep them to just say, look, you got to give yourself over to the pace of the movie. It's unlike anything you've ever seen, and you got to be willing to spend the time with these characters. But when this movie really takes off, it really takes off. And we haven't even really talked about the great, you know, the major car chase at the end. But, you know, it's like all practical. It was beautifully shot. It's, you know, he has a great sort of ethos about it, which is like, why would I do it if I'm not going to try to make the best one ever shot? You know, like,
and it is.
It
really is.
And it is. Yeah. And to put his special spin on it. But, I mean, I just remember the feeling that you and I had this, we went to see it, you know, I think we saw it the first time in your theater, but we went to another theater that had a fairly big audience. And that moment at the end when, you know, when the girls win and it just slams to that title, you know, that like that frozen frame in the title. And there was like a burst of laughter. And then applaud, you know, and it was just that release. It was like somebody like releasing the pressure valve of that. And so I think I would sell it to like, look, it's going to take a while to get going, but when it does, it is really fun and really satisfying.
I agree. I can't add anything to that. I think it's such a fun movie, but it's such an interesting movie too. And I got listeners. If you're out there, if you haven't seen the movie, sorry for spoiling it. One, but two, watch it for yourself. But if you have watched the movie and you didn't really care for it so much the first time around, now that your expectations are already set, give it another shot, especially the extended cut. You know, if you saw it as part of the Grindhouse double feature, I think there's something like 20 minutes cut out of the movie, including a pretty incredible lap dance sequence with the Vanessa Ferlito character. But definitely check out the longer cut of the movie. There's additional dialogue. There's that cut scene. And I think it's a stronger version of the movie. I can't imagine ever revisiting the Grindhouse cut again. You know, I can't imagine ever revisiting Grindhouse again now that we have extended cuts of Planet Terror and Death Proof on disc, you know, except maybe for those trailers, which are so much fun. You know, there was what, Machete, Don't, Thanksgiving, and was it Werewolf Women of the SS?
Yes, Werewolf Women of the SS. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I still want to see all of those movies. Like, I know we got Machete, but I still want to see Edgar Wright's Don't. I still want to see Zombies, Werewolf Women. I still want to see Eli Roth's Thanksgiving, damn it. I feel like, you know, if audiences had shown up the way they should have and had given that movie a shot, I feel like we should be on, like, Grindhouse 6 or 7 or 8 by now.
Well, that's the real tragedy of it not taking off the way it did. I mean, like you said, we should have been having one of these every year. You know, could you imagine if we'd had the Machete and Thanksgiving and, you know, and Don't and some other great movie along the way too. I just feel like, we were robbed of that.
I agree. There's an alternate universe out there somewhere where they're totally enjoying all of those movies. Right. They're in addition to a Grindhouse 8 or 9 coming out right now, they also have like Halloween 25 that carries on from John Carpenter's original anthology idea, you know, where it wasn't Michael Myers every sequel. So, yeah, I don't know. But yeah, so far as Death Proof goes, I personally give it a thumbs up. Listeners out there, definitely give it another shot or give it a first shot if you haven't seen it yet. But all right. I think that's just about our time. Mickey, thanks so much for joining us and for chatting about this movie. Thanks for bringing such a kick-ass movie for us to talk about. But
it was a blast.
Thanks so much. Where can folks find you online?
You can find me on Twitter, MickeyFisher73. You can find me again. That's probably the best place. Yeah, it's probably the best place to start.
Rock on. All right. Thanks again. And as always, folks, make certain to like, subscribe, share, check out our YouTube show, leave us a comment at ScreamAddicts.com. And if you want to check out Death Proof or give it a second shot, make certain to use the Amazon link on our site to purchase it. We get a kickback from it, and every little bit helps keep the show going. So yell at us on Facebook and Twitter. That's at Scream Addicts, and I am at Jinx1981. Also, we have a special for Scream Addicts listeners through Audible. If you sign up for a 30-day free trial, you get 2 free books, which is kind of cool. So, gang, thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next Friday with a brand new episode. Until then, have a great weekend. We'll catch you later.